This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 169, Virtual Surgery and Artificial Black Boxes. Welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, joined today by my fabulous friend and co-host. That would be Michael Rowe on a beautiful, sunny North Carolina spring day. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Fantastic.
Fan-freaking-tastic.
Not freaking fantastic, but pretty fantastic. You know, it's a good day and good things are happening and good news stories are coming across our feed and it's a beautiful day and you and I need to get outside and enjoy it. So what do you say we just jump into the show?
Exactly. Let's do it.
So the first article was one that you came across from a website called Strange Parts, which is a very interesting website, strangeparts.com, about a guy who built from parts his very own iPhone.
Yes.
This is really cool.
I have to give credit where credit is due on this one. This actually came from last night's Daily Tech News show. They were talking about it. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me go look at the story. And this guy's an engineer. He's in China. And he decided to go to one of these markets where you can get pretty much used parts for everything. Or parts for everything. So parts is parts.
Parts.
He built a iPhone 6S. And since he already owns an iPhone 6S, his plan was to build a new one from parts and then use his existing one as a reference model to make sure that he got it right. But he basically built it without tearing his own apart. And
That's pretty good.
Yeah, there was really only two things that I understand were a little bit more than simple or that made it easier, one of the two, right? One is getting the chip, right? The Apple chip, which then immediately makes everything work because iOS and everything kind of checks for that. Then the second, which was a big surprise, was the unbelievably inexpensive battery. So it's like they're everywhere is $5 or less for the battery. And so when you think about taking a existing phone in for a battery replacement due to problems with it, that can be, what, $100, $150? So you can start seeing where the margins are.
Well, yeah, and the teardown sites typically do that sort of thing. But I hadn't thought that the battery was like that cheap. That's just super inexpensive.
Yeah, yeah. And given how modular all this is, he's basically building a refurb, even though it's not a refurb, right? So the question that came up in the discussion, which I thought was interesting, was how much of these parts were someone buying an old iPhone, breaking them apart to components and selling the components in these markets versus black or gray market, grabbing components off the assembly line and bringing them out into one of these markets. And then once you have all the actual components, it's pretty easy to make an existing model of an iPhone because all the schematics and stuff kind of leak out there. And you, like you said, you could, if you needed to, break open his own and use it as a reference model to build it. My question, which wasn't really addressed, was could he have taken this and built a more powerful iPhone 6S? Like, so instead of putting 16 gigs of RAM in there, put 512 gigs of RAM.
Sure. Or put a battery in there that would let it go for days, you know, like a car battery.
Well, not in the same case, though.
You might have to make a case a little bit bigger.
Yeah. And if you think about how Apple likes to control the entire experience of their devices, so hardware, software, et cetera, if he had upgraded it to 512 gig of RAM, since Apple doesn't make one with that amount of memory, would the logic board have gone, nope, no, 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 no. You can't do that. You can't be real.
Or the software. the yeah. software might not have addressed it at that level too.
Yeah.
You know, when I read this, I was brought back in time to my days in high school. Yeah, exactly. It's my days in high school where one of the guys on my hall had built Macintosh computers essentially from parts. Mm-hmm. And I was really excited about it because I was like, oh, this would be fantastic. I'd love to be able to do this. But unfortunately, even then, the parts, at least what could be found here in North Carolina, were still expensive. They weren't as expensive as the finished product, but they were still so expensive that it was unfortunately an unsurmountable cost for me in high school to get those bits. But it was kind of neat that he was able to do that even, you know, way back then.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, gosh, what was it, 10 or 11 years ago, I turned an old ThinkPad into a Hackintosh.
Now, I should remember this, but I'm struggling.
Yeah, yeah. So Apple's Macintosh operating system uses a certain type of bootloader, which requires very specific kind of startup things to be identified at boot time, which is how they can lock it to their hardware. And so right. there's a community out there that actually has hacked the bootloader to allow you to install on non-Apple equipment. And then you can get the whole Mac operating system on non-Mac hardware. And I went to a conference out in San Francisco. Oh God, what was it called? Like Supernova mm-hmm. was the conference in 2007. And I had just gotten my old ThinkPad all booted up as a fully functioning Hackintosh. And some of the things that were a little bit flaky were like the wireless and a couple other things, but I got it working. And I'm sitting there in a session at the conference and Apple released an update. And I went, sure, go. And bricked it. Because
and promptly bricked it.
Yes, because the environment on the Hackintosh knew how to fake the stack, and with an update to the operating system, the stack changed, and it barfed on me. Luckily, I had a second hard drive that I popped in and booted back up over to Windows.
That was lucky.
Yeah, yeah. But it was really cool. It was really cool. And in a similar vein, gosh, my brother and I in elementary school took apart our family's lawnmower down to individual components and rebuilt it. So kind of like this guy bought all the individual components and built the iPhone. We almost built the lawnmower.
That's pretty cool too.
It worked afterwards. It had a bucket full of parts left over, but it worked.
Was it faster and stronger?
It worked for years afterwards, as a matter of fact, even with a bucket full of parts.
Don't know where these things go, but you know.
Well, they went into the bucket. Well, I don't think that would work on an iPhone.
Of cool things and avoiding kicking a bucket, we found another interesting article, this time from the New Scientist, about a virtual experience for surgery. So we've talked about a couple versions of these in the game mode, Adult Swim version, a few other things like that. And in this case, we have something called Fundamental VR. So it's a London-based outfit. And what they do is they have a training simulation for syringes that you can begin to learn as a practicing surgeon how much effort and how much pressure you want to be placing. Gosh, I need a pop filter for all those P's I'm saying right now. But
precisely
for what precisely for how much effort and push you want to put onto that syringe. And that is a very interesting thing because you're getting the haptic feedback from the actual syringe device as well as the visual feedback from the VR environment.
Yes, and the picture that goes with this is just gruesome, right?
It's surgically gruesome, yeah.
Yeah.
So for 5,000 pounds, that's, you know, UK money there for you, you could have one of these in your own home.
Well, the thing that I'm trying to figure out is the VR surgery that's happening. They're showing in the article, I assume that's probably somebody at a conference testing this thing out. And then in the background, they actually have the VR environment showing that he's probably in. And that VR actually looks like an actual knee going through surgery.
Yeah, it kind of does, right? It's all wrapped up nicely. It's got the appropriate devices holding the incision open, you know, all that kind of good fun stuff.
Yeah, and I'm wondering where the kneecap is.
Oh, maybe it's off to the side and you get to pick it up with your virtual glove later.
Yeah, but this is, yeah, this is really cool. I mean, one of the things, there's so much that you can do with visual and auditory stimulation in virtual environments. But having that haptic feedback to provide that one additional layer of input, especially when you're training something that is touch sensitive, is really, really cool. This is really nice.
And it's super easy to see how this kind of a model could work with distance medicine too, where there might be something where a surgeon or a doctor could be in a remote space and still perform a manual type of surgery because the device that's in a remote space provides that haptic feedback against the doctor's pressure that's happening somewhere else in the world too. So you could see where the same concept can be used and extended to do more than just a virtual reality sort of training environment.
Yeah.
So very cool stuff there, even though it has a knee that's doing its thing. All right. So last article for us for today was one that I know for you and for me, we are both intrigued with machine learning and artificial intelligence and the like. And this article is from the MIT Technology Review, focusing on the desire to understand the rationale that machine learning environments go through when making decisions. So the case in point that they're talking about here is where machine learning and artificial intelligence determines whether or not an individual qualifies for a credit card could be something that government organizations, certainly banks and others, want to understand so that the business rules that are emerging as part of that kind of decision making are surfaced and brought to the fore so they can be understood and interrogated and potentially even corrected if they're making even the right decisions for the wrong reasons. So I found this to be very intriguing, and the applicability for needing this kind of transparency is huge.
Well, I think this is a discussion that's been going on for some time. Just think back to the Watson Jeopardy challenge, right? And the desire to show how it couldn't really show how it got to the decision. It showed the top three answers it came up with, and its confidence that any individual answer was correct. And you start going through this and you look at much more complex decision points than just, you know, what's the capital of Montana, right?
Right.
And understanding the accuracy of a decision is critical in all kinds of business situations. So, yes, there are compliance issues for something like a credit card acceptance or denial, right? The algorithm look at all the data relevant to address any regulatory or compliance issues? If I have a piece of heavy equipment and I'm predicting a maintenance event that needs to come up, and I say, you know, you really need to change that ball bearing Thursday because if you don't, you'll have a plant outage on Friday and it'll cost you millions of dollars of downtime.
Right.
Are you going to shut down the plant Thursday for a half hour to replace that ball bearing if the confidence interval is only 10%, or if the data that was used to make the decision is irrelevant, or is it irrelevant because it might be the butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil, right? So how do we as individuals and programmers and processes that tend to be built off of a set of very transparent decision points, accept the output of an answer from a very opaque black box that many learning systems are. So how do you expose what was learned and how that learning drove a decision? I think this is a fascinating area of technology and understanding that needs to occur, especially as more and more complex and interesting problems start getting addressed through machine learning.
You know, I'm just taking a quick spin through the comments here, too. The last comment talks about the necessity for explainability and auditability, mm-hmm. right?
It's the whole compliance issue.
Yeah, and it's a compliance issue. It's a risk issue. That particular author writes a little bit of funny about solving all human problems in a way that humans aren't necessary. And then that comment is followed up with one about where blockchain and distributed ledger come into play. And while that's not further explained in that quick little hit,
That doesn't explain it at all. All that says is you could expose it, you could then put an indelible ledger out there to describe how you got there.
Exactly right. So if you made a decision, you made a decision based on these criteria, and these criteria that were used to make the decision and the method now can be written to the blockchain and saved and stored and only made visible to those with the appropriate access and entitlement to that information. And that would be a way then to know, because a machine learning environment is always learning. So what it knew at the time could be encapsulated in that kind of decision making and an explanation that then could be interrogated later if you wanted to see, okay, well, 3 weeks ago when this decision was made by this AI, what did it know? How did it know it? And how did it make that decision?
Yeah, well, what's really interesting, I was reading an article recently, and I've been trying to re-find it, so I haven't been able to find it yet. But basically, the idea is around, for lack of a better term, I'll call it memory permanence in an AI system.
Uh-huh.
So if you ask the question right now to a system, based off of the data it knows, the neural pathways are structured one way and the answer is X. 3 months from now, as those neural pathways are either reinforced or degraded based off of new learnings, would you get the same answer? How can you prove that?
The answer is no.
How do you prove the auditability, right?
The answer is yes and no. It depends on what the AI, the machine learning environment, has learned in that time, right?
Well, even if it didn't learn anything new, it just learned more of the same data.
Yep.
It may have learned 80% more of one type of data. So the other 20% data becomes less important.
Right. So it's coming to the same conclusion, but the reasons why it came to that same conclusion might be different 3 months from now.
Yeah.
And that is the interesting part too, because here we get to the Escher example, right? The hand that's drawing itself, the understanding the differences about decisions that were made today and 3 months from now could now be reviewed and understood to improve decision making 4 months from now.
Well, remember our friend at Hazardous Software, Chris Hazard, right?
Yeah, Chris Hazard, of course.
And the whole game mechanic of time travel.
Yep.
It's the same thing in that regard, because if I see that you have tanks coming over the horizon and I jump back in time to blow up the tank factory so that the time the tanks came over the horizon, they wouldn't be there, so they couldn't come over the horizon, and then you see that I did that.
Yep.
You start getting into all these different, basically their learning that occurred that allowed me to go back and change something, which now changes, in theory, the learning that could occur.
True. And if I'm able to transmit my algorithms of what I know now into the future so that they're able to learn something and then bring that back to the past or the present, that could be good too.
Yeah. Now, And I'm not trying to make a joke of it either, right?
I'm not either.
Want to know, how did you make the decision at the point the decision was made?
This is an interesting element around regret too.
Yes.
Right? The concept of regret implies that more knowledge at a future state implies that you would make a different decision in a past state.
Right. Which you can't. Because it's in the past.
Right? It's in the past. And unless you're able to go into the past, theoretically, can't really help you because you made the best decision you could at the time that you did with the information at hand and the algorithms you were able to use.
Yeah.
Whew. So time travel, machine learning, blockchain, artificial intelligence. What else can we fit into that bucket, Michael?
Well, there's a couple of new games that I've been playing. One of them is at least space travel.
Okay, well that works. Tell us about it.
And I pinged the link. Now I've totally gone blank on the name again. It's called Hyperburner, which is currently free, and it's kind of an endless runner in three dimension, where you're constantly going forward through the screen instead of right or left. And it's all these really cool geometrical shapes that are constantly moving that you got to fly your craft through.
Nice.
And kind of really cool graphics. Haven't turned up the sound yet to figure out if I like the sound. It's not hard. But instead of allowing you to just, tilt your phone or your iPad to fly, you're actually using a finger on the screen to change the directions. I think it would be much cooler if it allowed you to just use the accelerometer.
True. Well, yes and no.
Yes and yes.
Tilting the thing around sometimes can be less fun and more trouble than it's worth. So I've been messing around with Shooty Skies, which is something that's been around for quite a while, but it has a new update for it. As you reach certain holidays, people add more things to it. So I've been playing a little bit more of Shooty Skies than I have been for a while. And that gameplay is very much put your finger on the screen and move your craft around by where your finger is on the screen.
And that's what this is too.
Yeah.
Now,
so that's why I'm not a big accelerometer fan for that, for those sort of things.
Yeah, I like accelerometer. It's a little bit more visceral, and it would be more immersive to me. The other game that's totally unrelated and just kind of goofy silly is Bacon Escape.
Oh, tell me about that. I love bacon.
Yes. And basically,
who doesn't, right?
You're a pig that escapes from jail and gets in a mine cart and goes traveling down an endless runner of a mine cart on the track. And there's different things that you want to jump over or flip switches to go different routes, etc. Good, simple, mindless fun.
We'll definitely have to give those two a checkout and see how they work.
Yes.
Well, folks, this brings us to the end of our time here for you and for us. So we hope you've enjoyed these couple of different things that have found their way into our feed. If you are interested in something particular, please feel free to shoot it our way. We'd like to see more about it. We'd love to chat about it and talk about it. You can reach us on our website, on Facebook, on Twitter, on practically any social network you can imagine, more than likely we are there. So love to hear from you and love to get some of your ideas and thoughts about what you're focusing on. And we'll catch you here again very soon on our next gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz. Dot biz.